Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The theme today, lessons the 17th century philosopher Spinoza has to offer our modern society and the challenges ahead. My guest, Professor Stephen Nadler. Welcome back, everyone. My guest from Madison, Wisconsin is Professor Stephen Nadler. Professor Nadler is the William Hay Professor in Humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he teaches early modern philosophy, primarily the 17th century and Jewish philosophy. He is regarded as one of the foremost scholars focusing on the life and thought of the Dutch-Portuguese philosopher Spinoza, who died rather young at the age of 44 in 1677. Professor Nadler received his doctorate at Columbia University and has held visiting professorships at the University of Amsterdam, University of Paris, Stanford University, University of Chicago. He has also been elected as a member of the National Academy of Arts and Sciences and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's written about a dozen books on Spinoza's life and work. His latest is Think Least of Death, Spinoza on How to Live and How to Die, published by Princeton University Press, which presents Spinoza's philosophy in a contemporary and a practical context. Stephen, it's nice to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
I'm sure many listeners right now have heard me reference the great 17th century philosopher Spinoza on many, many different broadcasts. He happens to be perhaps my favorite philosopher during the Age of Reason, and I believe he still has an important message and lessons to teach that address the conditions of our modern society and the cultural clashes and life's meaninglessness to some that we are witnessing among especially the younger generation and some of the older generation. I also have enormous respect for Spinoza standing up for his principles after he was ostracized by the Jewish community of his time and by the larger institutions of authority who labeled him a heretic and a danger to society. But since most listeners will likely only know Spinoza by name, can you first give us a biographical summary of who he was, his background, and his place and role in the early stages of the Age of Reason, which was eventually led into the emerging democracies and the rise of 19th century science? And what are Spinoza's most important books that you find are most relevant for today? The forum is yours.
Sure, thank you. Well, Spinoza was born in 1632 into a very interesting community. Amsterdam was perhaps the most tolerant and open society in early modern Europe. And among the people who found a home there were refugees from the Inquisitions in Spain and Portugal. And a lot of these refugees were what have been called conversos. That is, they were originally of Jewish descent, but had been forced to convert to Christianity, Catholicism, in Spain and Portugal. But the Inquisition and a lot of the Christian population in Iberia never really trusted the sincerity of these conversions. And so the Inquisition came down very hard on these conversos and suspected them of still being in secret practicing Jews. So a lot of these families fled. They ended up in Italy, Salonika, and elsewhere, but a fair number ended up in Amsterdam, where they were allowed to return to open Jewish practice. And Spinoza was born to parents who themselves had fled Portugal, but he was born in Amsterdam, and the family was a fairly well-to-do merchant family in what was a growing Portuguese Jewish community in the city. And we know that Spinoza went through a typical Jewish education, although it was a very strange community because there were still remnants of Catholicism and they were still re-educating themselves into the norms of Judaism. But Spinoza went through the Jewish educational system up to a certain age. He did not train to be a rabbi, as has often been suggested. We know, in fact, that he never went into the upper levels of the Jewish educational system in the Portuguese community, because when his father died, he had to turn to the family business and help out there. We know so little about Spinoza's early years, and the biographical information is really scant, And then what we do know is that in 1656, Spinoza was issued the harshest writ of cherem, or I guess excommunication is the best term. And the cherem document, the longest cherem document ever issued by this community, speaks of his abominable heresies and monstrous deeds. So a cherem is a way of taking a person and punishing them socially, economically, and religiously. A person who was put under cherem is really, for a period of time, however the punishment is supposed to last, a kind of untouchable. They're not allowed to attend synagogue, participate in any kind of Jewish rituals. And usually a cherem lasted for a couple of days or a couple of weeks until the person apologized for whatever their transgression was and perhaps paid a fine. And you could be put under cherem for a long list of offenses that we find in the regulations of this Jewish community. For example, improper sexual relations, taking a book out of the library without permission, assaulting a rabbi. And the usual cherem documents are quite short, and they say so-and-so has been put under cherem and is not to be reintegrated until they have made such and such amends. The document detailing Spinoza's cherem is longer by far than any other cherem document of the period. It's a long list of curses and exclusions. Spinoza is no longer a part of the people of Israel. Let him be damned and cursed for his abominable heresies and monstrous deeds. Unfortunately, the document doesn't tell us what those abominable heresies and monstrous deeds were. So there's a lovely mystery at the heart of this consequential moment in Spinoza's life. And a great deal of speculation has gone on. Some scholars have argued that his offenses were actually financial. When his father died, Spinoza's, when he took over the family business, it was encumbered with a great deal of debt. And Spinoza, we know, did turn to the Dutch authorities and use a legal maneuver to relieve himself of these debts. And it was a legal maneuver that, even though it was permitted by Dutch law, was really a violation of Jewish law and the regulations of the community. And so it's been argued that Spinoza's real offense was this legal maneuver. I find that highly unbelievable, because abominable heresies and the length and vitriol in this document speak of something much more serious, more threatening to the community than illegal or business irregularity. I think Spinoza's offense were his ideas. And so on the one hand, you have this mystery. Why was Spinoza excommunicated with such prejudice? On the other hand, for anybody who reads Spinoza's mature treatises, and especially his philosophical masterpiece, which is called The Ethics, and a later work, somewhat later work, called The Theological Political Treatise, anybody who reads these works will see that there's really no great mystery here, and that if Spinoza was saying any of the kinds of things that we find in those treatises around the time of the cherem, when he was only 23 years old, and there is good evidence that he was saying these things then, there's really no mystery here. So what are the main themes of Spinoza's thought? What are the basic ideas in these treatises? We can sum them up by five basic points. First of all, Spinoza denies that there is any such thing as a transcendent providential God. To think that God is a kind of moral being with psychological features such as beliefs and judgments and expectations and hopes, this is to anthropomorphize God, and it's a very dangerous superstition, he thinks. God, for Spinoza, is not some kind of eternal, all-powerful person or agent. God, for Spinoza, does not have any moral characteristics like justice or wisdom. God does not have any psychological characteristics like belief or expectations. Spinoza's God does not issue laws and expect people to obey them. God, for Spinoza, is just nature. That is, in my view, all there is nature. There is nothing outside of nature. And whatever happens, happens within nature, and according to nature's laws, with an absolute necessity. There is nothing that is transcendent of nature. There is no supernatural. So that's the first major thesis of Spinoza's ethics. Second, because everything happens within nature and through nature with an absolute deterministic necessity, it follows, Spinoza insists, that miracles are impossible. Because a miracle is defined as God violating the laws of nature to create exceptionally some event. But if God just is nature, if there is nothing but nature and happens, and everything that happens happens through nature, then exceptions to nature are in principle impossible. So it's not just the kind of position that you find in later Enlightenment thinkers such as David Hume, who says that the belief in miracles is never justified. Spinoza says it's not just that the belief is not justified, they are metaphysically impossible. So there's a second thesis of Spinoza's philosophy. Third, Spinoza thinks that the Bible is not some divinely communicated word of scientific, historical, and religious truth. Rather, the Bible, as Spinoza sees it, and he really represents the beginning of true biblical scholarship, the Bible is nothing but a collection of human writings composed over many generations and then handed down through the centuries by a very fallible process of transmission. Finally, these writings are selected by a team of editors late in the Second Temple period, put together selectively, with a great deal of editorial care, but also a great deal of editorial exclusion. And so the work that we have really is what he calls a mutilated and corrupt book. It's a work, it's really an anthology of human writings, or a collection of stories that may or may not be exactly what was written so many millennia ago. Therefore, the Bible is not to be seen as a source of scientific truth. It doesn't give us knowledge about the world. It doesn't give us knowledge about history. And it does not give us true knowledge about God, because the authors of these writings were not philosophers or scientists. However, the Bible does have a special value in Spinoza's view, because it is a morally edifying work. That is, the authors of the Bible were individuals of great ethical character and very vivid imaginations. And so their special skill was in constructing stories that inspire us to treat other human beings with justice and charity. And that's true piety. True religion is, and this is the fourth point, true religion is nothing but treating other human beings in proper moral ways and helping them improve their lives through acts of justice and charity. True religion has nothing to do with superstitious ceremonies, worship, reverence. It has nothing to do with worshiping the words on the pages of a certain book or following the dictates of some priest or rabbi or imam or pastor. True piety, true religion, consists in a life of justice and charity. So that's the fourth point. Finally, and I think this may have been one of the aggravating factors behind the decision to put a cherem on Spinoza, he denies that there is any such thing as a world to come or an eternal heaven and hell, and there is no such thing as an immortal soul. For Spinoza, when you're dead, you're dead. There is no afterlife. And to believe in an afterlife, to believe that you have an immortal soul, and that this soul will receive either an eternal reward in heaven or an eternal punishment in hell, those are superstitious beliefs, very pernicious superstitious beliefs, because if you really hold on to those things, then your life in this world will be governed by the irrational passions of hope and fear. You will have this irrational hope for eternal reward and an irrational fear of eternal punishment. And that is a life of enslavement, a life of bondage to the irrational passions. And rather than enjoying the fruits of virtue and reason and the happiness and joy that comes with focusing on what constitutes a good life in this world, you will become overly anxious about these superstitious rewards or punishments that might await you in the next world. And that, for Spinoza, means that you are more likely to throw yourself at the mercy of ecclesiastics who will manipulate your emotions to get you to do what they want you to do. And that means as well that the state, the political state in which you live, will be as well influenced by these religious authorities rather than governed by true justice and charity. So those are the five very important principles, I think, of Spinoza's philosophy. Also, the five principles that probably caused great scandal in his time because they were seen as a threat to the power of the ecclesiastic authorities, as well as a kind of independent rational thinking and secularity that many civil, academic, and religious authorities simply couldn't tolerate.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. One observation I've heard repeatedly by university professors who have been on this program, such as McMaster University's Henry Giroux, Mark Crispin Miller, New York University, Gene Twinge, and others like Jonathan Haidt, is that younger social media generations lack keen critical thinking skills. This touches upon the role of reason in our lives and how reason can curb the illusions of relying solely upon our emotions or our self-centered passions. We're witnessing the outburst of passions in the streets now, both from the left and the right. I don't find much critical thought behind either of these movements underway, certainly not on the right and its supremacist groups. And although the left is lifting up the important issues of racism and bringing it to the surface, I find an utter lack of reason in how it's being framed. One could argue that there is a lot of superstition fueling these passions, certainly among far-right Christian groups that believe in militant behavior or the rise of QAnon. This is something you touch upon, that is, Spinoza's view of the importance of reason as a means to guide our lives and to counter superstitions and their beliefs that are then converted into irrational actions. So explain in a little more depth, please, with maybe some examples, how Spinoza viewed reason and its role in a progressive society. And does he speak about how reason differs from what we might call intuition?
I do think it's an important question to raise today, and it was as well in the 17th century. Where do you get your information from? Why and how do you form your beliefs? Or the question I like to ask about our current American society is really, how literate are we? Where are we getting our information? Are we getting it in sound bites over social media, or are we getting it through the close study of information that comes to us from science, from philosophers, and from other thoughtful sources? Spinoza distinguishes in his work, The Ethics, three different kinds of ways of knowing. And really, the first way of knowing is not really a way of knowing whatsoever. It's just a way of forming beliefs haphazardly. He calls this first kind of knowledge either sensation or imagination or opinion, very similar to the kind of distinction that Plato drew in antiquity between opinion and knowledge. And this is a matter of forming beliefs through random experiences, is the phrase he uses. Forming beliefs quickly, not on the basis of sufficient evidence, forming them from a very narrow perspective, and really thinking you know things when what you really know is simply the way in which they happen to affect you at the moment or have affected you in the past. And this is an unreliable way to arrive at true beliefs. It's not well grounded in the evidence. These are not fully justified beliefs. The second kind of knowledge he calls reason. And reason is a deeper understanding, not just of what things are, but why they are as they are. So when you have understanding through reason, you have a very thorough causal knowledge that explains why things are as they are. And so to know not just what the fact is, but why the fact is a fact. And this, I think, refers especially to the kind of understanding that science provides us of things. When you have a scientific knowledge of whatever phenomenon it is you're investigating, you have a causal explanation for that phenomenon. You have a theory both that covers the nature of the phenomenon and the antecedent causal factors that, in light of some covering law of nature, explains why those facts are as they are. And Spinoza believes that until you have this, what he calls an adequate understanding of things, you really don't understand much at all. The third kind of knowledge, he calls it intuition, and this is in a way the knowledge that has most puzzled Spinoza scholars. What does he mean by intuition? And it's tempting to think that he means by intuition what we often so casually mean by intuition, namely something that comes off the top of your head, a brief but flashy insight, not grounded in understanding. That is not what Spinoza means by intuition. People see in Spinoza what they want to see in Spinoza. And I think for many people and many movements, Spinoza has served as a kind of Rorschach test, that they see there what they hope to see there. And so people who are given to mysticism see in Spinoza's account of intuition a mystical kind of insight. Likewise, socialists have seen Spinoza as a proto-socialist. Zionists have seen Spinoza as a proto-Zionist, and so on. But I think there is no mysticism whatsoever in Spinoza. And what he calls intuition is really just a deep enough grasp of what was already known by reason, so that you no longer have to go through the process of inference to learn what you need to learn. So you can't just get to intuition without going through reason. You only learn through reason the true understanding of things. You can only acquire an adequate knowledge through reason and then synthesize that. And what intuition gives you is a way to formulate that knowledge as what he calls essences of things. And so to truly know something by intuition is, I think, to have a deep and abiding understanding of what you are as a human being, what nature is, what your place in nature is, what the place of human beings is in nature, and how human beings are no less and no more a part of nature than anything else. And that deep understanding of what we are and how we relate to the world should, in Spinoza's eyes, he says, bring us a kind of equanimity. And this is the moral side of this. We shouldn't think of Spinoza simply as this rationalist who is interested only in epistemology or the theory of knowledge. His project was a large-scale moral and political project. And if there is a single grand theme running throughout all of his writings, it's freedom. The ethics is about the freedom of the individual and how that freedom is acquired through rational understanding and how you can free yourself from a bondage to the passions. The theological political treatise, which he published in 1670 to great alarm, caused a great scandal, that is about political and religious freedom. And when you acquire this third kind of knowledge and you have this deep understanding of yourself, of nature, and of how things are all a part of nature, including not just our bodies, but our minds, and how everything is subject to the laws of nature with a deterministic necessity, this understanding brings to you a kind of peace of mind, a very tranquil condition, not unlike the equanimity that the ancient Stoics insisted came once you realized how much of life and how much of the world is not under your control. And so rather than trying to control things out there and getting overwhelmed emotionally by the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, to quote Hamlet, by trying to control the acquisition of things you love or avoid the losses of things that are dear to you, which are not under your control, once you recognize the necessity of all of nature, that brings with it a kind of release from this emotional bondage. You won't feel the emotions as strongly, and your reason will therefore be empowered. And the life you live will not be directed by your feelings, but rather by your rational understandings of things. And that is what Spinoza would describe as the right way of living, a good life, a life living under the guidance of reason, doing what you know to be truly good, as opposed to simply pursuing those things that happen to make you feel good.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Spinoza's ethical philosophy really comes down to what it means to live a good, rewarding, meaningful, and joyful life, as you mentioned. That is why I value his philosophy. I hold different points of view on whether there's an afterlife or not. But this is tied to his view of what he calls a free man or free person. What would be Spinoza's exemplar or ideal of a free person?
A free person, and there's been a lot of debate about this, whether it's an impossible ideal, that striving to become the free person is like striving to become God. You can't do it, but it's a sort of asymptote that you can hope to get closer and closer to. I actually think for Spinoza, the free person is a real and possible ideal, and it represents an individual who, while they do experience the passions, you can't go through life without stubbing your toe and feeling pain, or without seeing a loved one pass away, without going through the ups and downs of romance. Sadness and joy, the pleasures and pains that come with being a part of nature, and Spinoza stresses so many times that a human being cannot not be a part of nature. You will always have passions. You will always have emotions that are passively caused by things outside of you. You will always be reacting to things. So the question is not, can you elevate yourself above nature, but rather, how do you deal with nature? Do you let these passions guide you? Do you pursue things because of some unjustified belief that they are good? Or is your life guided by what you know to be truly in your best interest? That is, by what reason indicates is truly beneficial to your physical and mental well-being. And it's important to stress for Spinoza, and this is where I think he departs from some of his philosophical mentors like Descartes, that what's at stake here is not just the condition of something that Descartes calls the soul. You're not trying to ignore the demands of the body and concentrate on the health of your soul. Because for Spinoza, mind and body are intimately connected. One is a reflection of the other or an expression of the other. The mind, he says, is simply the mental correlate of the body. And you cannot have a healthy mind without a healthy body and vice versa. What the rational or free person knows is what is best suited for benefiting this mind-body combination. What brings us into a state of better or higher perfection improves the mind's power, improves the body's power. The free person will live their life with the rational guidance that knowledge brings as to how to improve your condition. The non-free person is simply chasing transient pleasures and avoiding transient pains, thinking that this is where happiness lies, as opposed to pursuing the true good, which brings us what he calls salvation. And he doesn't mean by salvation some kind of divinely conferred eternal salvation. He means the highest kind of joy that a human being can experience through the life of reason in this world.
Jonathan Haidt speaks a lot about the flaws and the adverse effects of people who are raised with an entrenched sense of personal self-entitlement. Many children are being raised to feel entitled rather than earning something, even their own happiness and sense of freedom through their own efforts. What would Spinoza say about our society of self-entitlement, especially we have something relatively new, and that is a very large and growing professional class? Richard Gell and I did the homework and found about 16 to 17 million professionals, lawyers, doctors, scientists, engineers, highly educated people, And they would be considered by any standard today the upper class, but not the wealthiest class. They're not in the millionaire class, most of them, and they're not in the uber rich. We have about 400 billionaires in the United States. We have about 12 million millionaires in the United States, but we have 17 million professionals, and they want to live as if they're the richest. They, you know, they want their kids to go to NYU and have their own co-op, not stay in a dorm. So they have to go into debt to do that. And this creates enormous stress upon the individual creating that, working extra long hours and having very little time to spend in providing the guidance, discipline, emotional, spiritual, ethical, and social values that would allow that child to be empowered within a society. So as a result, the internet becomes the surrogate parent, and all their so-called friends and all the other platforms they are become their peers. And this is what makes it rather unique, since it's not just a generational difference in how parenting is done today, but it also is a value difference. But both are the same in one sense. The medical doctor working 70 hours so that they can make enough money to have what they believe is a standard of living commensurate with their position in society also has had to make sacrifices of what they will not be able to have for themselves or their children: free time, time to have hobbies, time to be with loved ones. Everything is hyperkinetically pushed forward. And as a result, we have an entire generation today with extraordinarily superficial, non-depth values and understanding of the world we live in. Whereas when Spinoza was alive and others during that time, the family was everything. You had to first support the family, and then by extension, the family had to support the common values of the community, and the community, the larger values of the society in which it lived. It had to find ways of adapting positively rather than maladapting. And so Spinoza was in that time where you could take your time. There was time to do things. Today, there's very little time to do anything. So how would he look upon our world if he suddenly were awakened into the consciousness of what it is to be in our society today?
I think that was all well put, although I wouldn't underestimate the extent to which, even in Spinoza's time, people were chasing false gods or untrue values. I think every age has its follies. And yes, there was more time to pay attention to important things in the 17th century than there are today, or these people made the time for it. At the same time, they had their own superstitions. They had their own false pursuits. There was as much self-entitlement and pomposity and false consciousness in the early modern period as there is today. Still, your point's well taken, and especially given the speed at which we try to do things, I think one of our great critics of this is Bill McKibben, who some years ago wrote a book called The Age of Missing Information. And he contrasted two ways of spending his time through the course of this book. One way was to watch 24 hours worth of television and spent days watching this television, trying to determine how much information he actually got from doing so. The other side of his time was spent sitting on a mountaintop and walking through the woods, and how much information he acquired doing that. And it's just a beautifully poetic indictment of our age of missing information. Self-entitlement is an interesting way to characterize what's going on. To the extent that an individual feels what we call self-entitlement, we usually mean that, I think, and perhaps you meant it this way, as a pejorative, namely, you overvalue yourself and what you deserve. And Spinoza saw this as a serious vice, because one of the virtues of the life of reason, the person who is a free person, is that they have an appropriate and true valuation of what they are and what their self-worth is, and a proper understanding of what contributes to that self-worth and that value. So he argues both against overvaluing yourself arrogantly, and that would be self-entitlement, but he also argues against undervaluing yourself, that is humility, or false, not just false humility, but where humility is a kind of not recognizing your true value and worth. The free person is somebody who has an accurate assessment of what they are. The other point you make, I think, is also very well taken, that to the extent that you devote your time chasing after superficial goods like more wealth than is necessary for a comfortable life, honor, political power, and especially the high opinion of others, to the extent that you spend your life chasing after these things, you will have less, if not no, time to devote to pursuing what things that really are more important. That is the improvement of your understanding, your intellect, your education, your knowledge, your physical health. These sacrifices that you describe people making, they're not just sacrifices that they think, oh, well, I can do without that for the sake of this. But they are deep and serious sacrifices because parents are thereby modeling for their children a kind of life. And they're saying, well, look, this is the good life. You need to pursue this as well. And I think we as an American society are seeing now in the current administration, in the current current cognitive environment where people form beliefs without any evidence, and they hold on to those beliefs in the face of counter evidence. For me, it's, why do they believe that the COVID virus is caused by 5G networks? Why would they think that a certain person who is so obviously unqualified to be president nonetheless has their own best economic interests in mind? Conspiracy theories all over the place, QAnon, during the 2016 election, Pizzagate. American society has become, and I'll just use this word, and I mean this word in a technical philosophical sense, America has become full of stupidity. And by stupid, I don't mean just the kind of schoolyard epithet. I mean we are no longer forming beliefs the way we should in a rational and epistemically responsible way. Beliefs should be acquired on the basis of evidence. And when evidence turns against your belief, you should give up the belief. That is what Spinoza would call the life of reason. And that's how a free person leads their life. I think he would be astounded by the irrationality that governs not just individuals, but public policy in this country. And the lack of literariness and the lack of epistemic responsibility, testing your beliefs, seeking out not just confirmation of them, but falsification. That's what a true test of a belief is, to see if it's false, to see if there is any counter evidence. All of this is the kind of thing that gets lost with the kind of world you've described, in the kind of society where self-entitlement leads to a faster and faster pursuit of things that really do undermine our mental and physical and environmental and political and social and moral well-being.
That's a bit of a rant, insight.
But I think it's a good rant.
I don't think it was a rant. I thought it was an extemporaneous flowing of insights coalescing into a better understanding of where we are today. You made it right. I would add to what you said that not only do we have people in positions of power over our lives who are unqualified by any metrics, but we've had that same power. It's just that the other power in our lives over the last, let's say, 30, 40 years have been people who've had a better persona, more charming, less combative, more gracious, more humorous. And as a result, we frequently ask is that person looking presidential, as if somehow that had a meaning that was right. commensurate with their duties and obligations and capacities. And one of the reasons that I do not attack the president is because I do not feel that it is a polite to attack a 10-year-old. And
yes.
therefore, he is not, if he cannot understand the nature of the argument, he is going to miss its deeper meaning. That said, there's one thing that we rarely talk about in our society, and that is death. It is something we will all have to embrace at some point, some with dignity, others with fear, some with a deep sense of loss, and others before they feel that it was their time. And I believe we're afraid of the discussion. We're afraid to face this gigantic issue in all of our lives because as a scientist, and I spent 33 years as the senior research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology and head of the anti-aging division there, and I did hundreds of, well, not hundreds, 140 experiments and 44 clinical studies in aging. The question was, is there some way that we can actually slow down the aging process? And the answer is yes, absolutely. The science is overwhelming. But then the question is it something that people would have to participate in order to gain the benefits of extra years of life and extra health during those years, better cognition, et cetera? And the answer is yes, they would have to participate. Then the question is, will people do it? And the answer is no. Very few people will change, especially their comforts. And one of the biggest comforts we have is we are addicted to our comfort, especially of our ideological, religious, interpersonal, familial, and cultural beliefs. We rarely want to hold them up and examine them to say, is there anything within this belief that I should deconstruct for my own well-being? And yet Spinoza did that. Spinoza was what we would consider today one of the first real professing atheists. And so when we die, he believes that is the end of everything. There is no eternal soul or divine providence. It is rather Epicurean compared to other Eurocentric countries, and the U.S. is still predominantly religious. Although atheism is on the rise among young adults, so much of our narrative is framed with either religious language or tinged with religious values. But Spinoza ties his view of our eventual mortality with being a free person, not a religious person who believes in a promise and an afterlife. And as you mentioned earlier in your program, when you were going through the five principles that were the foundation of his belief caused him to be considered a heretic, one of the most formidable was that how much of your life is dictated and your actions, your beliefs, your rituals, based upon if I suffer during this life, I will be rewarded in the next life. And in fact, people throughout history, especially those who were the serfs, those who were at the bottom end of a power dynamic, believed as long as I suffer, I'm a better person. And therefore that whole mantra is I am a better person because I suffer, and not looking at the consequences of that warped mindset. So those in power said, yes, you suffer and you will be rewarded. It's even true today in many religions. However, I don't notice that he draws any distinction between what we would call the mind, meaning our mental phenomena, that can be correlated to brain activity, and consciousness or awareness, which is the neurosciences are still clueless to explain or account for. Please explain this relationship between living a free life, but in full recognition of our mortality, and how would this contribute to living an ethical life?
So let me first say something about what you described as the uncomfortableness. And this, I think, is extremely important for Spinoza, just as it was for Socrates. And I think if you were to ask Spinoza, who is your philosophical hero, he would no doubt, among others, say Socrates, because Socrates recognized that self-examination, or living the examined life, is a very uncomfortable thing. It forces you to look at your beliefs and your life in ways you hadn't looked at before. And what you may discover could be very disturbing, especially if you do it later in life and you realize that the things you were pursuing were not truly satisfying or truly good. So absolutely, it's an uncomfortable and very difficult thing to do, to go through this process of rational examination. You mentioned also Epicurus. And here, I think, too, Spinoza has a forerunner in the Epicurean philosophy. Although the Epicureans were materialists, Spinoza, that is, they thought that there's nothing but matter. Spinoza is not a materialist because he does believe that the mind and the mental world is as much a real part of nature as the material or physical world, and that our mental life is a reflection or an expression of our physical bodies. And in this sense, Spinoza is much more modern than, let's say, Descartes, who believed that the soul was an independent substance that did not depend ontologically on the body. For Spinoza, the capacities, the faculties, and the achievements of the mind are a reflection of the faculties and complexities and processes of the body, very closely united. However, the body, and here we get to the point about death, the body will have its demise. Hopefully it does not come in for a very long time, and one lives a long, healthy, and fruitful life. But at a certain point, we are what he calls finite durational beings, and the body, like all material things, will cease to function with its typical motion of life. When that happens for Spinoza, the mind ceases as well, because it is a function or an expression of the body. And so the self comes to an end. When the body dies, the self dies. Epicurus, I think, had the right attitude here. He counseled us not to fear death. And he and one of his followers, Lucretius, repeated the following statement, fear not death, for where death is, I am not, and where I am, death is not. And so if your attitude towards death is fear because you're afraid of what will happen to you after you've died, that's an irrational fear because you're not there after you've died, you are dead. And so nothing is going to happen to you, and so don't be concerned with it. What you should be concerned with is this life where you are, because there is no death here for you yet. The ancient Stoics had a different attitude. And here Spinoza, I think, departs from the Stoics. The Stoics, Seneca, for example, insisted that the best way to deal with death is to think constantly of it. Always ponder your mortality, and that way you'll be ready for it. Spinoza's free person knows that there is no life after death, that the end of this existence is the end of the self. And so this person will not fear death. They won't be anxious about it. They might, of course, fear how they're going to die. I mean, we do not want to go through a painful extended process. And I think it's perfectly legitimate to be afraid of when one might die, whether one might die prematurely, or what the process of dying is like. Spinoza could certainly allow for that, and I wouldn't think that would be an irrational thing to be concerned with. However, the free person is not going to fear death being dead. They're not going to be anxious about it. They may regret the loss of the things that they currently have, and this, you know, a lot of philosophers lately have turned to the question of death and what is the appropriate attitude to take towards death. John Martin Fisher is a philosopher who's given a lot of attention to these questions. Would immortality, in fact, be desirable? What should we feel about death? Should we be afraid of it? Should we be anxious about it? Should we look forward to it? These are all important philosophical questions. Spinoza's free person, however, is focused almost exclusively on the joys to be achieved in this lifetime, and especially the joy that constitutes, that's constituted by living the fullest human life as a rational being. And so this person not only has no interest in thinking about death, but really has no energy to give to it because their focus, their attention is on other things, other more important things, how to make this life better rather than how to avoid something that is not waiting for you on some other world.
I appreciate that. My final question is hypothetical. If we were to imagine that Spinoza's ideas were a norm today, what might our culture look like now, and how would this shape our politics today?
Boy, would we be in much better shape. We would certainly be a much more literate society because we will have studied philosophy. And by literate, I mean not just capable of reading, but reading the right stuff. We wouldn't be consumed with the cult of celebrity. Going back to a point you made before, we wouldn't be electing our political leaders based upon whether you want to have a beer with them or whether they are good looking or speak a good game or whether they appeal to our baser instincts. We would choose our leaders, our political, our president, our politicians, our senators, congress people, and so on. We choose them on the basis of whether or not they are truly qualified. What really bothers me is this this complaint that we don't want to be led by elites. I, for one, would really like to be led by elites, not financial or economic elites, but intellectual elites. I want the people who are steering this country, and this I take this to be a very Spinozistic point, the people who are steering this country need to be intellectually superior individuals. They need to know not just what economics is about and what is in the financial health of the economy. I think that's extremely important. But this idea that being president is like running a business is a complete fallacy, because running a business, you don't have to have at the front of your mind concerns with justice and fairness and good and bad and security. What I want in political leaders, and again, speaking as a Spinozist, are people who know what justice is. It's also a very Socratic point. Plato in the Republic said, the best thing for the state is when philosophers are rulers. And I presumably he doesn't mean academic philosophers, although you know, I could see some academic philosophers who make very good rulers and some who would be very bad rulers, but rather people who are philosophically inclined, who want to ask about the justification of beliefs, about truth and falsehood, about good and bad, who have a strong sense of justice and also a good enough practical wisdom to know what brings justice. And I think to bring the word wisdom in here is crucial. What I see lacking in so many of the people who are leaders in this country is wisdom, that is a sense of what is right and how to pursue it in the most effective way. And I think Spinoza, when he argues in the Theological Political Treatise for the dominance of a political class that is not governed by superstition, but that is led by a firm understanding of what truly is in the best interest of their citizens, that would be the ideal state.
Thank you very much. Professor Stephen Ladler, a William Hay Professor in Humanities, University of Wisconsin, and the author of an extremely important book that is entitled Think Least of Death, Spinoza on How to Live and How to Die, published by Princeton University Press. We really appreciate you being on a Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.